Hello, thank you very much for joining us for this webinar. I'm Anne-Marie Balfour, a legal director in the employment team at Charles Russell Speechleys, and I'm joined today by Rose Carey, a partner and head of our immigration team. Over the next hour or so, Rose and I are going to be taking you through an update on immigration and employment law in relation to Brexit. There's a couple of important points I wanted to mention at the start. The first one is that we're recording this webinar in early July 2020. Negotiations are ongoing and it's possible that things may change. The other point I wanted to make is that we're going to be talking about the law of England and Wales. Obviously, Scotland and Northern Ireland are affected by Brexit too, but they're separate jurisdictions. We'll be looking at England and Wales. So first then, a look at what we're going to cover in this webinar. So we've set out on the slide an overview of the topics for today. First of all, we'll have a look generally at Brexit. Where are we now? What's the current position? We'll then take a look at EU law, EU-derived law in the UK, and what's going to happen to that as a result of Brexit. That's in relation to the law generally. We'll then focus more on employment law and take a look at the story so far with Brexit and employment law over the last 4 years or so. And then also what might change in employment law as a result of Brexit. I'll then be handing over to Rose. Rose, can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be speaking about?
Yes, thanks, Anne-Marie. So I will be looking at Brexit immigration law, what the current position is for EU nationals, and then what happens at the end of the transition period from the 1st of January 21, and what the new immigration system will look like and how it will apply to EU nationals. And then Anne-Marie and I will give you some practical tips.
So first then, let's have a look at the at Brexit generally. Where are we now? And as I said earlier, we're recording this webinar at, we're presenting this webinar in early July 2020. The the Brexit referendum took place just over 4 years ago, and the UK has now already left the EU. That happened on the 31st of January 2020. We're now in a transition period or a standstill period, or sometimes called an implementation period. And the intention of that was to allow time for negotiation of a new agreement governing trade. So in terms of this transition period, for now, for employment lawyers, not a lot has really changed in our day-to-day work. During transition, the EU law and law enforcement continues to apply in the UK. The UK continues to enjoy the same trading relationship with the EU, but the UK is no longer represented at the EU institutions. So that's what happens during transition. And the transition period ends on at 11 p.m. on the 31st of December 2020. In the meantime, the negotiations are ongoing between the UK and the EU. So it's possible things could change. It's fair to say that the focus of those negotiations is not really employment law. It's other matters, for example, phishing, competition, pandemic response. But nonetheless, we could expect to see some change perhaps, and some more information in relation to employment law in the coming months. So looking next then at what happens with EU law as a result of Brexit. Obviously, over the last, almost 50 years, there's been an awful lot of law and an awful lot of employment law that's been driven by the UK's membership of the EU. I've put on this slide some of the main relevant legislation in this area. So we have the 1972 European Communities Act, which of course comes from the time when the UK joined the EU. Then in relation to Brexit, we have two main acts of Parliament. The first is the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018, and the second is the European Union Withdrawal Agreement Act 2020. Also on the slide are a couple of statutory instruments which probably look a bit more interesting for employment lawyers than they actually are. I'll say a little bit more about those in a moment. So that's the legislation, but what in practical terms actually happens to the that EU law in the UK after the end of the transition period? Well, firstly, the 1972 Act is repealed, and that means the end of the supremacy of EU law in the UK. So all of those 50 years of law that have been built on the 1972 Act would come crashing down. That would be chaos. Something needs to replace it. And of course, there isn't time to rewrite all of those laws. So what the 2018 Act does is effectively onshore all of that law and bring it onto the bring it into domestic law. So some would call it a cut and paste exercise. We take the EU law as it is, as a snapshot at the end of transition, and then that becomes UK domestic law. And that body of law that's created, it crystallises at the end of transition period, and it's called retained EU law. And it includes EU legislation, UK legislation that derives from EU requirements, and also decisions of the European Court of Justice. Now, as with any cut and paste type exercise, copy and paste type exercise, it's not going to be a perfect fit. So what the 2018 Act also does is give power to make smaller amendments to the retained EU law by way of secondary legislation, just so that it works and so it operates effectively. And a couple of examples of that are on the previous slide in relation to employment law. So the idea is it's a huge task. It's going to take years, but it does things like if there's a reference to one of the EU institutions, then that will need to be amended. And because it's such a huge task, and because perhaps the line between what's an administrative change and what's a more substantive change could perhaps become blurred, one can see how this could become a source of confusion as we go forward following transition. A quick word on those two statutory instruments in relation to employment law. The first makes some changes in relation to European Works Councils. The second makes some other changes to other employment legislation. But in fact, it's just wording changes. There's nothing that substantially changes employment rights in those changes. Coming back then to what happens in the UK at the end of transition, the new decisions of the ECJ will not be binding on the courts and tribunals in England and Wales and the UK. So that means ECJ decisions that are handed down after the end of the transition period. Now, the courts and tribunals in the UK can have regard to those new decisions if they would like to. There's nothing to stop that, but there's no obligation to do so. And equally, if you have a claim that you're working on and there is a new ECJ decision that's relevant to the issues in that claim, there's no reason at all why you can't refer to that. It's just that the court or tribunal you're in wouldn't be bound to follow that new European decision. Also, following transition, as I said, we have this body of retained EU law, and it includes decisions of the European courts. Following transition, the Supreme Court will have the power to overrule those ECJ decisions, just as it has the power to overrule its own decisions. Now, interestingly, that power could also be given to some lower courts, and the Ministry of Justice is consulting on that at the moment. Of interest to employment lawyers, it's unlikely to extend that power to the employment tribunals, and the consultation currently looks as if what there is in mind is extending that power to overrule the ECJ retained decisions, to the Court of Appeal or possibly to the High Court as well. So it will be interesting to see what happens, and it will be something that affects employment law. Also, following transition, the UK won't need to comply with new EU directives. So currently in the pipeline is the whistleblowing directive, the Work-Life Balance Directive, and the Transparent and Predictable Working Conditions Directive. As it stands, the UK won't need to implement those directives. And finally, after transition ends, there will be no more referral to the European courts from the UK courts. So that's a look at what happens to EU-derived law in the UK generally. But let's look now in particular at employment law. So the story so far, obviously, it's now 4 years since the referendum. But even since the referendum and before, the idea of how Brexit might affect employment law was something that was of interest and often talked about, speculated about. Back in 2016, we had the widely reported suggestion that Brexit would result in a bonfire of workers' rights. Now, as the story's unfolded over the last few years, employment law hasn't been at the very centre of things, but it is fair to say that it's a common thread that's been running through the developments as we go along, with hints and clues as to what might happen being dropped here and there, and sometimes more than that. In summary, there's still no legally binding commitment to any sort of level of employment law or workers' rights protection being guaranteed following Brexit. And as we've seen earlier, there's certainly, at least in theory, some scope for divergence from EU law afterwards. If we have a quick look at the developments over the last few years, just some of the points which have stood out. So in 2016, the Prime Minister at the time stated that workers' existing legal rights would continue to be guaranteed in law for so long as she was Prime Minister. Then in 2017, we had a white paper which included 12 guiding principles on Brexit. One of those was protecting workers' rights. We have the Northern Ireland Protocol, not legally binding, but interestingly for employment lawyers, a previous draft included provisions preventing the UK from regressing below EU employment standards. And that was for the whole of the UK, not just for Northern Ireland. That is no longer the case. That provision isn't in the current Northern Ireland Protocol. The 2019 political declaration is a text from October 2019, which sort of sets the scene for the negotiations between the UK and the EU. And that stated that the UK and the EU were determined to work together to safeguard workers' rights. It dealt with a lot of other points as well. Very interestingly, the draft 2020 Act originally contained some very specific wording around employment law, and it included an obligation on the government to issue a non-regression statement in relation to all new employment bills, and also a duty to consult with unions. It also included a duty to report regularly on new EU workers' rights, so to report on what's going on still in the EU in relation to the topic. In fact, those points were removed before the 2020 Act was passed, so they don't appear in the final version. However, in the Queen's speech towards the end of 2019, it was stated that there will be a new employment bill to enhance and protect workers' rights. And so we will wait and see what's in that bill. So as we saw earlier, there's clearly scope for divergence from EU law, and potentially, at least technically, there's scope for very considerable divergence from EU law following Brexit and following the end of the transition period. However, it's not thought that there are going to be sweeping changes or that we're going to see dramatic change to employment law as a result of Brexit. And that's for a number of reasons. Firstly, there may yet be trade agreements which require a minimum level of employment rights protection. Also, there's an awful lot of employment law in the UK that has nothing to do with the UK's membership of the EU. So for example, unfair dismissal law, shared parental leave, minimum wage, and the right to request flexible working are all domestic laws. And therefore, there doesn't really seem to be any reason why Brexit would make any difference to those. Also, when the UK has implemented EU laws, it has often gone further than the minimum level required by membership of the EU and has actually gold-plated that minimum standard. So, for example, we have the GP regulations and maternity rights, to name a couple of them. And again, it would seem strange if just the fact of Brexit would mean that we would row back from those when we have already gold-plated those in the UK. And also, of course, we need to look at the context generally. So customers generally expect a certain level of social responsibility from suppliers, and therefore would still expect certain standards, even if they weren't actually legal requirements. Also, a lot of employment law has been integrated into our daily lives in the UK. If we take as an example discrimination and equality law, it does seem almost unthinkable that at present discrimination law would be downgraded in a material way right now. There has been some discussion about whether discrimination law would change as a result of Brexit, but those discussions have generally involved points like a possible cap on compensation for discrimination claims, or the possibility of making it easier to promote positive discrimination, but all speculation at present. Also thinking about the social context, of course, Brexit's not the only issue on the minds of employers, employees, or pretty much anybody else at the moment. We are, of course, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And in the UK, millions of workers have been furloughed. Many are working from home. Many are unfortunately looking at redundancies, and many businesses are struggling to survive. We're seeing a number of initiatives to preserve jobs, and therefore any changes in relation to Brexit and employment law would also be in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's not thought that there are going to be sweeping changes because of Brexit. That said, the UK has in the past quite strongly opposed certain EU-driven legislation, and it seems reasonable to think that those might be the ones that would be most vulnerable to change following the end of transition when there is some freedom to make some changes. For example, the Agency Workers Regulations 2020, the UK opposed those quite strongly, perhaps because the UK uses agency workers rather differently than most other member states. That said, though, protection for atypical workers is also a hot topic in employment law following the Taylor review. So it will be interesting to see whether, in fact, there are any changes in relation to agency workers. Similarly unpopular, for some, are the working time decisions in relation to holiday pay and sickness absence. So, for example, ECJ decisions on whether holiday pay needs to include more than just basic pay, so for example, overtime, and also in relation to long-term sickness and the accrual of holiday during the long-term sickness absence. So, again, it's possible that we may see some divergence from those decisions. However, by far the most important Brexit-related issue for employers, in my view, is the end of free movement of workers. And so now over to Rose to talk about that some more.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Yes, indeed. Some changes coming up for EU nationals from January. But at the moment, free movement still exists for EU nationals. And what do we mean by free movement? Well, it means that nationals of all the member states of the EU and the three European Economic Area countries and Swiss nationals are able to live and work in the UK without being subject to immigration control. And that is the position at the moment until the end of the transition period on the 31st of December 2020. EU nationals who are resident in the UK, as well as EEA and Swiss nationals, they are able to register under the EU settlement scheme, and they are also able to apply for permanent residence under the EU system, which is in place until 31st of November 2020. So, what does that mean? Well, it means that they will have either permanent residence in the UK at the end of the transition period if they are applying for permanent residence under the EU system, or if they apply under the EU settlement scheme, they will get settled status, if they have resided for 5 years in the UK, or if they have not resided for 5 years, then they can acquire pre-settled status. And then once they have met the 5 years requirement, they can then apply for their settled status. And we're going to come on to look at both of those schemes in a moment as to which one is the right one for the applicant to use. Importantly, the EU settlement scheme only applies to EU nationals who have entered the UK before the end of the transition period. When I talk about EU nationals throughout this presentation, I am including the EEA nationals and Swiss nationals as well. But before we look at the permanent residence scheme and the settlement scheme in more detail, let's just look at Irish citizens and what their position is, because this is quite an interesting situation. Irish citizens actually have free movement in the UK outside of the EU regulations. So Irish citizens will have EU free movement, but also UK free movement. So there's a special arrangement between the UK, the Republic of Ireland, and the Crown dependencies. So that's the Isle of Man, Jersey, and Guernsey. They are all part of something called the Common Travel Area. And that actually facilitates free movement throughout those regions. So British nationals have free movement in Ireland, and Irish nationals have free movement within the UK and the island. And this actually reflects our regional history and has its roots in the foundation of the Irish Free State in 1922, and was then carried over into the establishment of the Republic of Ireland. So it predates the EU, it predates when the UK joined the European Community in 73. So it starts in 1922 and it's completely separate to the principle of EEA free movement. So Irish nationals are in this wonderful position that they have the benefits of free movement in Europe and the UK. So who knows what might happen in the future with their immigration system, but it might become quite a popular destination. So Irish nationals do not need any documentation other than their passport to prove their right to reside and work in the UK. So going back to permanent residence. So as I said, this is an application that's based in European Union law. And it actually applies throughout the EU. So once someone has met the residence requirements for a continuous period of 5 years, and they have exercised the treaty right, they are able to qualify for permanent residence in that member state. And it still applies in the UK until the end of the transition period. The individual just has to show that they have been resident for a continuous 5 year period, with their absences being no more than 6 months a year in each year, and it's calculated on a calendar year basis. They also have to show that they are a qualified person, so that means that they have been exercising a treaty right throughout the five-year period, and that could be as a worker, employed or self-employed, self-sufficient person, a student, even a work seeker, and family members of qualified persons will also be able to apply as long as they meet the 5 years residence requirements. Minor criminal convictions, interestingly, are not a bar to applying. So it's only serious criminal convictions that would prevent someone from having a successful application. And the application is submitted online, or it can be submitted using a paper application form with supporting documentation. The documentation is quite onerous. There's a lot of documents around evidencing not only residence throughout the 5 years, but also the exercise of treaty rights. So, for example, if they worked in the UK for those 5 years, they would need P60s, payslips, letters from their employer. Now, you might think, why would someone use this route and not the EU settlement route? Well, this route is beneficial if someone wants to apply for citizenship. They want to naturalise as a British citizen because it can be backdated. So the EU settlement scheme, it is not possible to backdate the status, but with this permanent residence scheme, it is. So the applicant could pick an earlier period such as 2014 to 2019. And the reason that's important is when someone naturalises as a British citizen, they have to show that they have held their permanent residence or settled status for 12 months. Unless they're married to a British national. So if they're not married to a British national, they need to have held this permanent residence or settled status for 12 months. So with permanent residence, that status can be backdated. So as soon as they get the application approved and it's been backdated, they can immediately apply to naturalise as British without having to wait for 12 months. And for some nationals, that's quite important because some countries in the EU do not allow their nationals to acquire a second nationality unless it's with another member state of the EU. So the UK still counts during the transition period. So for those nationals, it's really important that they get their permanent residence now so they can get it backdated and then apply for their British citizenship before the end of the transition period. And that applies to German nationals. And we often advise German nationals on making permanent residence applications because they want to acquire citizenship. So what about the EU settlement scheme? Well, this is a much easier application to make. And it is the same status as permanent residence. It's a permanent right to reside in the UK. And because it's an easier application to make, this is the application most applicants should use unless they want to naturalise as British and need to get their permanent residence backdated. It's very simple in terms of the criteria. The applicant just has to show that they've been resident for 5 years and that their absences are no more than 180 days in any 12-month period. Interestingly, unlike permanent residence, this is calculated on a rolling basis. So permanent residence is calculated on a calendar basis, but with settled status, it's any 12-month period in the 5 years, the absences must be no more than 180 days. There is no requirement to show exercise of treaty rights. It's just pure residence requirements. So have they been resident for a continuous 5 year period? And they just need to evidence that with documentation showing their residence in the UK, such as council tax statements, utility bills, bank statements. And then criminal convictions potentially could be more of an issue with this type of application. And some convictions, even if they are not serious, might be an issue, such as convictions relating to immigration offences. If an applicant doesn't qualify for settled status because they haven't lived in the UK for the required period of time, then they can apply for what's called pre-settled status. And with pre-settled status, they will be given a 5 year right to reside. The document is electronic, and that proves their right to live and work in the UK visa-free for 5 years. In order to qualify for that pre-settled status, they must enter the UK before the 31st of December 2020, so before the cutoff at 11 p.m. And they have until the 30th of June 21 to register, but they have to enter before 31st December 2020. That's really important. There is no backdating of the settled status, as I mentioned before. So that's something that you might want to flag to clients if you're advising clients on this, because they may want to look at the permanent residence application. So what happens to EU nationals who are coming to the UK after the end of the transition period, so from 1st of January 21, where we all have a new immigration system? Well, it's been called the new immigration system, but in reality, it's really tweaking the existing system and bringing back some old visa categories that were removed a few years ago. So the major changes are around Tier 2. So Tier 2 is a work visa where there is a UK employer who will sponsor a worker to work for them in the UK, and the employer needs to have a Tier 2 sponsor license in place. So the UK employer has to make sure they have that. If they don't have that already, they need to apply for it. It takes around 8 to 12 weeks to get that license in place. And there's two types of Tier 2 work visas: Tier 2 general, which is used for generally new hires to the business, and it leads to settlement in the UK after 5 years, and Tier 2 intra-company transfer, which is for a fixed period of time. It does not lead to permanent residence to settled status, and it's for a finite period. Tier 2 intra-company transfer is for an employee that's working for the business in another office in another country who will be moving to the UK for a period of time. Now, Tier 2 at the moment is quite restricted in terms of the roles that are eligible for sponsorship. It's currently set at RQF level 6, which is a graduate level role. And Tier 2 general also requires the employer in most cases to have advertised the role in the UK to make sure there are no suitable resident local workers who can do the role. And the salary is also set at a minimum of 30,000 for Tier 2 general. Well, many of those restrictions will be lifted from the 1st of January, and those restrictions that are being lifted will apply to non-EU nationals as well as EU nationals. So non-EU nationals will benefit from this slightly easier tier two system. And the salary is being reduced for Tier 2 General to 25,600. It may even be possible to reduce it down further to just under 21,000 if the role is a shortage occupation. But generally, the minimum salary is going to be 25,600 in most cases. And then there's going to be removal of the resident labour market test for Tier 2 General as well. So employers will not need to advertise that role and justify why they are not employing a local resident worker. And then interestingly, the skill level will be coming down to RQF level 3, which is A-level skill. So that's going to open up a lot more roles to applicants. So many roles that are previously unable to receive sponsorship will be eligible. And then there's the possible introduction of the highly skilled migrant visa. This was a visa category that was in place for many years and then was removed several years ago. And it's a visa for those who are highly skilled, they have good academics, perhaps a lot of work experience, have been high earners, and they score points based on their skills, their work experience, their academic qualifications, and they are able to obtain a visa. And that enables them to work in the UK. And it has very few restrictions, unlike Tier 2, which is restricted to a particular role and a particular employer who has the sponsor licence. A highly skilled migrant visa will be open to the individual to work for different employers. It's not tied to a particular employer or a particular role necessarily. But that visa category has only been canvassed recently. It's not necessarily going to come in next year, but it may come in. And I'm a big fan of this visa category. I think it's a great visa. Many other countries have something similar, like Australia. So we will see whether that does come in next year. If it does, it will certainly make the UK quite an attractive country for highly skilled migrants to come to. Tier 1 post-study work is a two-year working visa for UK graduates who are graduating from summer 21. And it will enable them to work in the UK for 2 years, and it's a stepping stone really to Tier 2. So what are the issues with this new system and how will it affect EU nationals? Well, one of the big issues is the cost. A Tier 2 visa issued for 5 years for a small business would cost them around £5,000. And for a medium to large employer, it would probably cost just under £9,000. So that's per employee for a five-year visa, and that's not including family members. Many employers will help to pay for the visa costs for the spouse and children as well. So that's very costly, particularly for small businesses, as to how they are going to be able to afford that if they currently employ a lot of EU nationals come 1st of January. To employ EU nationals in the UK who are not already resident here, they're going to need to use Tier 2, and that could become quite costly. So that's one of the problems. And another problem is around the administration of Tier 2. It's a lot of self-management for the employer, and they have a lot of compliance duties. So that places quite a lot of pressure on the employer, and it's an administration burden as well. So they're going to have to get used to that and used to engaging with the immigration system, which they may not have been used to before. And another issue is around the business person visa category. We had an entrepreneur business visa category, which was removed last year, and it hasn't really been replaced with any other visa for a business person. The innovator visa was introduced last year, but it is tied to an endorsing body, and the business has to be innovative, scalable, profitable, and viable. And because it requires endorsements, it's very difficult to get that visa in place. Many clients will often use the Tier 1 investor visa, but that has a very high minimum investment level of £2 million. So it doesn't work in many cases. And although the investor visa is unlikely to undergo any immediate changes, there may be some changes next year around evidencing source of funds, which can be a bit problematic in terms of getting the documentation together. So there are some issues with this new or not so new immigration system that we will have in January, and how employers are going to cope with it, particularly employers who are not used to dealing with an immigration system in the UK. They are going to have to get used to the costs and the administration of the system. So I think one of the things employers need to bear in mind is that they are going to have to plan ahead. And we're going to look at some top tips in a moment on immigration. But before we do that, I'm going to hand back to Anne-Marie, who's going to take us through her top tips.
So looking at some top tips on the employment side then, firstly, employers who have employees performing jobs that mean they have to have professional qualifications. So for example, lawyers, medics, architects and vets. Those employers need to have a look at the arrangements they have for checking the employees have the correct qualifications, both the existing employees and also looking at new recruits looking ahead to the future. At present, there is a mutual arrangement for acceptance of professional qualifications within the EEA. As things stand, that's due to end at the end of the transition period at the end of this year. And similarly, for employers in regulated sectors, for example, financial services, if your employees are going to be doing regulated work, then it's definitely sensible to check that the arrangements you have in place will be sufficient following the end of transition. And that's particularly important where services are being provided to clients outside the UK and in the EEA. Another sensible thing to do for employers is to have a look at pension arrangements for employees. In particular, in relation to defined benefit schemes, there are some potential issues if there's no separate deal around that. Also, I'd recommend employers with European Works Councils review those, in particular looking at any links with the UK for those European Works Councils. So perhaps it's subject to UK law of some kind, whether that's England and Wales or otherwise. And that would be sensible to check. Also, if UK employees have been counted in any way relevant to your European Works Council, then they're no longer going to count. So a review to check that still works, it would be very sensible. Next, in relation to the Posted Workers Directive. So this is a directive which states that if you are working in an EU member state and you're temporarily posted to another one, in that host country, you have the same level of employment rights as those working there permanently in that host country. That will no longer apply to postings into and out of the UK following transition. However, the thing to look out for is where a UK national is posted to an EU state and is then posted to a third country, which is also an EU member state, then the Posted Workers Directive would still apply to them, and that would be quite easy to overlook. Now, I think it's fair to say, Rose, that it's not always going to be straightforward whether some EEA nationals have the right to work and can evidence that for the purpose of right to work checks as things begin to change around the end of the year. And obviously, right to work checks, just as important as ever for employers. A word of warning around making sure that those checks are conducted in a way that is non-discriminatory and doesn't discriminate on grounds of race and nationality. And often we have this clash between immigration law and employment law for employers, and it can be very difficult to get it right all round, particularly with immigration-related dismissals. So it may turn out that somebody doesn't have the right to work, and therefore it wouldn't be lawful to continue to employ that person. It's very important to gather all of the facts to try to determine what that person's status actually is and to follow the best procedure you can and take care around relying on contravention of an enactment or illegality as a potentially fair ground for dismissal. Also, what we've seen as businesses prepare for Brexit is employers perhaps restructuring and reorganising, perhaps even moving to mainland Europe or moving certain people around. Now, it's probably obvious to say so, but there's no special exemption for Brexit-related restructuring, and plenty of time needs to be allowed for compliance with things like 2P, with collective redundancy obligations, individual redundancy, consultation, whether a mobility clause is being exercised reasonably, that sort of thing. And in the context of COVID-19, we can expect travel to be a bit disrupted and perhaps a bit unpredictable for some time to come. So that's worth bearing in mind with any rearranging and restructuring. A topic that pops up now and again is just how emotive a subject Brexit can be, and certainly around the time of the referendum and then again around exit day, it can be a topic of discussion in the workplace, and we can expect that to happen again as we come towards the end of the transition period later this year. The point for employers to be aware of here is that discrimination in relation to some political views can actually be an unlawful discrimination under the religion or belief discrimination legislation. And again, that's something to look out for. Also, in relation to Brexit, it's well worth reviewing employment contracts, and in particular, any templates or precedents that are used again and again. It might be that no changes are needed whatsoever, but a couple of examples of things to look out for are, for example, post-termination restrictive covenants. They sometimes refer to a particular geographical area, and sometimes you see references to the EU or to the EEA there. Now, at the time that was drafted, it may be that that was intended to pick up the UK or certain parts of it. And following Brexit, it actually wouldn't work in the same way as intended when first drafted. So something to pick up and amend there. Also, as we've seen case law evolving from the ECJ, some employment contracts have also evolved to match those decisions, particularly around issues of holiday pay and sick pay. Now, if, and this is a big if speculatively, but if the UK is going to diverge from EU law, it might be that in fact those clauses are more generous than they need to be. So when reviewing employment contracts, it's sensible to have a think about those and whether there might be a different way of drafting that would make them perhaps a bit more future-proof as we move on past the transition period. And lastly, really important point is things may well change, and so make sure you keep up to date with any changes. Those are my tips. Now over to Rose for her practical tips.
One of the things to consider is whether employers can bring recruitment forward, or at least arrange for the EU worker to come to the UK before the 1st of January 21, or in fact before 11 p.m. on the 31st of December 2020. So they can benefit from the EU settlement scheme because they can register for pre-settled status. And to register for pre-settled status, they don't need to have a UK permanent residence. They could even use a hotel as their UK base, and we have registered clients that have done that. They can also use their flight confirmations as evidence of their presence in the UK. So they just have to be present in the UK before the end of the transition period to be able to register under the EU settlement scheme. And then they would have a 5-year right to reside and work in the UK. And they wouldn't have to immediately start work or stay here. They could then pop back and make their arrangements and tidy up their affairs and then come back later in 21, because pre-settled status is maintained even if someone is outside the UK for up to 2 years. So it's only lost if they're out for 2 years or more in a continuous period. So that might be something to do, obviously factoring in COVID-19 lockdown problems, but something for employers to consider. And another tip is in relation to ensuring that existing EU staff have registered. So they've either got their permanent residence and naturalised as British, or they have registered under the EU settlement scheme, whether for settled status or pre-settled status. So it's important that they have done one of those things. And employers should also think about their British citizens who are working abroad in EU offices and what their position is. So that EU country will also have a permanent residence system. So any EU national may be able to qualify for permanent residence in that European country if they've lived in that country for 5 years. If they haven't, then they still may need to register. So it's important that that is looked into and followed. And then if an employer thinks they will need a sponsor license next year, they should think about applying for it now, because there's probably going to be a lot of applications, and then the time frame for getting that license in place is likely to take longer than the current 8 to 12 weeks. I think employers should also think about their recruitment needs and assess what roles may need a sponsored worker, and whether that role is eligible for sponsorship. Because even though the skill level is being reduced to RQF level 3, which is an A level qualified role, it may be that the role that they need to employ someone in is not going to be eligible. So, for example, in food and beverage, hospitality in particular, those sectors may struggle because many of those roles will not fall within RQF level 3 and therefore will not be eligible for sponsorship. So what will the employer do in that situation? How will they be able to fill those roles? So that's something that needs to be factored in. And then have a think about British nationals who are perhaps travelling to the EU on a frequent basis for work. Can they do that as a business visitor? Because business visitors will be able to travel to the UK and also from the UK to Europe visa free. But if that British national perhaps is spending a lot of time in that European country and effectively doing a job there, it may be that they will need a work visa for their work in that EU country. And then when applying for that sponsor license, I think employers really need to ensure that they're going to be able to meet the compliance requirements. So as it's very much a self-managed system, employers have a lot of compliance duties which focus around record keeping, so you know, records on right to work checks, and also about monitoring staff to ensure that they are aware if they're on holiday, if they're off sick, or if they're traveling on a business trip. And that's really important that employers are able to show that they can do that for the staff that they sponsor under their license, because it is a requirement for them to know where their sponsored workers are. So employers really need to make sure that they are going to be able to comply with their duties as a sponsor. So that's something that they should be looking at now. And then finally, right to work checks, which Anne-Marie also touched on. In relation to the immigration side of things, for EU workers, interestingly, the Home Office has confirmed that employers until 30th of June 21 can simply rely on the EU passport for the right to work check, which seems a bit bizarre when potentially an EU national coming to the UK from the 1st of January 21 may actually need a visa to work lawfully in the UK. But the Home Office are telling employers they only need to see the passport up until 30th of June 21. Then after June 21, they will need to check visas as well. I think that's quite conflicting information to give employers and puts them in a bit of a difficult position, as Anne-Marie has mentioned, in relation to discrimination. So that could be a bit of a minefield in terms of how to do a right to work check, because an EU employee might be saying, well, actually, you can just accept my passport. But then the employer will say, well, how do I know if you were here before 1st of January or if you came after the 1st of January, in which case you need a visa in order to work for us. So I think that's going to be quite a minefield. So it's really important that employers have a clear process and procedures in place so they know what they're doing in terms of those right to work checks.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Those are really helpful tips. That brings us to the end of our webinar today. There is a quiz if that's something you would like to do. There's more information on the last few slides about that. Otherwise, it just remains to say thank you very much for joining us for the webinar today. We really hope you enjoyed it. Goodbye.